Hey, please explain, listeners. Our live recording at the Antidote Festival at the Sydney Opera House is this Sunday at 4 p.m. So if you'd like to come, you'd better head to the link in our show notes today to grab some tickets.
I think they very much want to make a deal, and the longer they wait, the harder it is to put it back. But I have a lot of feeling for President Xi. Very outstanding in so many ways. But I told him very strongly, I said, look, you're starting up here, and you're making $500 billion a year and stealing our intellectual property. We're down on the floor, lower than the floor. You can't make a 50-50 deal. This has to be a deal that's better for us. And if it's not better, let's not do business together.
After discussions with President Donald Trump on the sidelines of the G7 this weekend, Prime Minister Scott Morrison stepped a little closer to picking sides in the US-China trade war.
We want to see the matter resolved. Now, the US has legitimate interests that they wish to pursue as part of that trading relationship. It's not for us to dictate to them any more than it is to China.
According to Mr. Morrison, the trade tensions were born out of deep structural issues, and any president in Mr. Trump's position would have faced the same set of circumstances. Once again, we're either headed for a deal or we're not. No one can predict with any certainty when the negotiation is living from tweet to tweet. But would a deal between the United States and China, which everyone is calling for, actually be that great for Australia? This is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. This week I'm joined by senior writer at the Sydney Morning Herald, Matt Wade, and Tim Harcourt, who's an economist from the University of New South Wales and the host of the Airport Economist podcast. We have talked about the trade war before on Please Explain, but this week it feels like a good week to revisit it because things have escalated and they're potentially heading towards a deal or they're potentially not heading towards a deal. Matt, can I start with you? Scott Morrison, on his departure from the G7 in France, made some pretty conciliatory statements towards Donald Trump about the trade war, suggesting that no matter who was the president of the United States, they would have been in the same circumstances in relation to their relationship with China that he has found himself in. A few months ago, he was very much sitting on the fence saying, we can't choose between our friends and our customers. But we appear to be inching towards having picked a side here, haven't we?
Well, I think it's fair to say that, you know, the United States has been concerned about China's behaviour in the trade space for a long time. I mean, it's taken multiple complaints to the World Trade Organization, which is the international body that I guess governs global trade, set up to sort of be the arbiter in trade disputes. Up until the Trump administration, the US had used that, if you like, rules-based system to try and resolve its problems. The big thing about Trump is he's completely departed from using the World Trade Organization, and he's decided to have a bilateral trade war with China. It's a complete change of tack by the United States. They have traditionally been, if you like, the leader of a rules-based trade system. They were instrumental in setting up this system that sort of governed global trade since the end of the Second World War, and it's been the foundation for incredible, I guess, global prosperity. You can't argue about that. But Trump has decided to change tactics. The problem for Morrison is that that global trading system, that rules-based system, has also been the foundation of our economic success, or one of the key pillars of that. So if he's endorsing a departure from that, I don't see how that's in Australia's interests. As to whether he's sort of choosing sides in this dispute, I guess that's our dilemma for Australia, is that we've got this historical traditional ally, military ally, security partner in the United States. Our biggest trading partner, though, is China.
Tim, how much of what has been happening in the last 6 months do you put down to personally to Donald Trump, and how much of it do you put down to sort of an incremental move towards these set of circumstances?
I think Matt's right. I think the WTO is as dead as a Doha, you know, when it comes to Donald Trump, in the sense that he thinks that rules-based systems are stacked against the United States, similar with NATO and other multilateral institutions.
NATO members must finally contribute their fair share and meet their financial obligations. But 23 of the 28 member nations are still not paying what they should be paying and what they are supposed to be paying for their defense. This is not fair to the people and taxpayers of the United States.
But I would say something that Matt's picked up on that's right is that the USA's had a problem with China for some time now, which precedes Donald Trump. And I think to some extent, the other world powers are great free riders in this. I actually think the EU and Brazil and Japan and South Korea are quite enjoying, and the EU are quite enjoying seeing Donald Trump take the lead against China, because they've had similar complaints with intellectual property, with the role of the state-owned enterprises in investment. So I think a lot of people are standing back and letting Trump go in really hard against China, hoping that he will make some progress. Of course, for traditional free trade economists, they're scared because basically no one wins with a trade war. On the other hand, I think there is a school of thought in Washington which is not about economics at all. It's geopolitics, and they just think that there's the rise of China here, one chance to, if you like, set the balance of power so that China does have to do a few things on intellectual property and state-owned enterprises before China potentially becomes too powerful that the United States doesn't have any bargaining power. So I think there's a geopolitical side to this, as well as a traditional, tariffs are bad type role that most of the traditional economics profession are taking.
Has there been any signals out of Beijing that they might be prepared to move towards changes on intellectual property and abiding by WTO rules? Or are they really staking their claim that they're outside that system?
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things is I mentioned how there'd been a lot of these complaints prior to Trump becoming president. And it's fair to say that in many cases, if not all cases, China played by the rules. They did accept the judgment of the WTO, and they kind of like were part of the rules-based system. But I think one of the big challenges here is it's like a structural problem, and that is, can the WTO, which was basically set up, I guess, by liberal democracies like the United States, Australia, Western Europe, can it manage having this completely unique player, China, a giant economy that's going to become more and more important, more and more dominant, or more and more significant in the global economy? But it's structurally just so different to those economies like the United States or Australia. That's a kind of a fundamental question that is challenging the WTO.
Okay.
That's the strains we're seeing, Tori, I think, in a sense there, even with Hong Kong. How does this one-party state, with not international businesses but branches of the government in terms of their state-owned enterprises like Huawei, how do they adjust to the world system and how do we adjust to them? And I think Matt's right. I mean, they could make some minor adjustments and live by WTO rules on intellectual property. But when it comes to the fundamentals of the Chinese economic system, they're not going to let it all unravel, for the sake of someone who's going to be in the White House for one more year and at most five more years. They're not going to give up that system that they've built up too easily, if at all.
So if we ended up in a situation where trade became a system of bilateral deals, and that the US and China made a deal, and therefore China then looked at who we're going to deal with next, how would we make a deal with China?
I mean, it's interesting. If you look at the market reaction over the past few days, over the weekend, it looked like the trade war was just taking a huge turn for the worse, really hotting up. Then at the end of the G7, both China and Trump have made statements about wanting to come up with a deal, and suddenly markets have reacted with kind of relief. But a deal is potentially very dangerous for the whole world or other trading partners, especially Australia. If you think about how deeply integrated we are with the Chinese economy in terms of our exports, our big relationship with America too on the trade and investment side, some sort of deal between China and America, it looks like it will, it's hard to see how Australia is not sort of come out worse off from that. I don't know if you agree, Tim, but the possibility is for it to be actually quite bad for Australia.
Well, I think that's right. We're in this dilemma where we don't want tensions between China and the United States to escalate to the extent that you have a trade war, because no one wins with a trade war, particularly a small open economy like Australia. But you actually don't want it to go too well, because if China and the US end up with a bilateral deal where it's managed trade, and they basically, China agrees to buy so many manufacturers, commodities, agricultural products from the US and not from us, we actually don't want that. So them getting along too well is bad for us. Them getting along very badly is bad for us. So we really want a bit of competitive tension but nothing too cataclysmic on, you know, either end of the scale.
And I think it's also interesting to look at, say, Trump's base. It's in states of the United States that tend to be agricultural producing. He's also very popular in mining communities. And what do we sell to China, especially mineral commodities, but also agricultural products? And so you can see a case with any deal, any more managed trade deal between China and the US, where those key constituencies for Donald Trump are likely to be campaigning very hard for a good deal. And they are exactly the products that Australia also sells to China. So you can see how we're exposed in that scenario.
How exposed are we as far as industries, like as far as international economies go? Are we at a higher risk than others because of our trade relationship with China at the moment?
I mean, I reckon Matt might disagree, but I mean, I'd say a place like Malaysia is more exposed. I mean, someone that's got very strong electronic ties to the US and to China, they're going to have some real difficulties. I mean, I think China's energy insecurity and food insecurity means they're going to rely on rocks and crops from Australia, you know, just to feed their people and to build the energy in those second and third tier cities that they're building up. You know, China's going from being a nation of shippers to a nation of shoppers, where they're really building up their consumption investment domestically. And for that, they need Australian energy exports and Australian food. I think to some extent, you know, we are locked in. But as Matt said, the sensitive states in the US during the election, so Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, they're farming and manufacturing states like Wisconsin, mining like Pennsylvania, even places like West Virginia, where Trump is actually very strong. The question is whether those states, despite the adverse impact on their commodities of a trade war, you know, if you're a soya bean farmer from Wisconsin or making Harley Davidsons, whether you still think, well, you know, we're going to cop this because the president's standing up to China, which is a good thing. So it could be that some people vote against their economic interests, depending on who the Democrats put up.
It's a terrible situation for Scott Morrison, isn't it? Because so much of it is outside our control. We really have to sort of sit and watch it play out without being able to influence what happens. But let's talk about what Australia can influence, which is our own posture towards China and our own sort of rhetoric. There has been an escalation in the media, in a justified manner, in my view, especially probably in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, about China influence in Australia, influence within our universities, over the behaviour in Hong Kong and the behaviour of some Chinese, mainland Chinese citizens here in Australia over what's happening in Hong Kong. There's a bit of heat in our relationship at the moment with China. How much of that would play into their thinking about trade with us?
Look, it's very hard to know how that will play out. However, you'd have to say that from a geostrategic point of view, this is an opportunity for China to remind Australia about just how important it is to our economic well-being. I mean, one of the interesting reflections I thought have is that there was such hope about the so-called Asian century. If you go back about 10 years, there was so much talk about the Asian century. And it's true, it's this incredible opportunity. But I think sometimes the debate about the Asian century in Australia has been kind of very one-dimensional. This is going to change us. This is going to be difficult. It's not going to be an easy road.
And we're still only at the beginning.
We're only at the beginning. You know, China's economic power is on the rise. It's not nearly as powerful as it will be in future. Indeed, other Asian countries like India are going to become much more powerful players in the global economy. And this is going to come with challenges. It's not an all upside sort of story. I mean, and that's the way often the Asian century is sort of being portrayed. I'm not saying for a moment it's not an amazing opportunity. You know, we've got these huge growing markets right on our doorstep. It's a great opportunity for Australia. But sometimes I think the debate has really ignored the fact that it's going to come with challenges, and we're facing one right now.
Tim, what would you do if you were advising Scott Morrison on how to navigate Australia through this current situation?
Can I take a slightly contrary view on this?
We like that, Tim.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this idea that Australia's just this hopeless, useless player and we've just got to cop what the US and China serves up to us is not true. I mean, Australia's a significant middle-income economy, a very successful economy in the region. We came up with the idea of APEC with the South Koreans under Bob Hawke's prime ministership. We played a very important role in the G20 finance ministers during the global financial crisis. I'd say Australia, we're not a superpower, but we're a country of significant middle power influence, and I think we have a good reputation in the region. And secondly, I think Matt's right about the Asian Century. It's actually a great opportunity, and I'm amazed in the Australian press, particularly in the ABC, the only time you ever see a business story reported is if someone gets thrown in jail in Indonesia or there's a corruption scandal, you know, in a casino in China. Meanwhile, there's 50,000 Australian exporters doing fantastic things all over the Asia Pacific. I find there's a great disconnect to what I see as a airport economist flying around the region and seeing success stories and what gets reported back home in the press. Finally, something that Matt's reflected on very strongly in his commentary about India. Asia's not just China, and the trade wars are not just US and China, and Trump was the only person at the G7. South Korea and Japan are in the middle of a trade war at the moment. Japan has downgraded South Korea's status and vice versa. China has offered to mediate, which not surprisingly has been rejected by Tokyo. So there's more to Asia and Australia's connections than just what Trump says about the Chinese. There's actually basically the engine of the world economy. And I'd say that, you know, if I was advising Scott Morrison, I'd say Australia's an influential player and a trusted player by all sides, and we can play an important role geopolitically.
Look, I'd also make the point that I've been watching the portrayal of the trade war in the Western media.
Mm.
It is very much being framed from a US point of view.
Mm.
We don't hear very much about, you know, from a Chinese point of view. And I think sometimes that skews the way we think about it. One of the facts is that a lot of the global media is very Washington-oriented, so we hear from a Washington point of view. Australia's in a different place, and I still think Australia is very underprepared for not only the Asian Century, but our relationship with China. I mean, we know where Wall Street is. We could probably name half a dozen states of America, but ask the typical Aussie to name half a dozen states of China and they'd struggle.
Or the currency.
Yeah.
Or the name of the currency. The index. Yeah.
So, look, it's changed in Australia a lot. It's been great. We hear a lot more about Chinese politics and society now, but I still think we've got a long way to go. And I think from an Australian point of view, we don't need to take our point of view on the trade war through Washington's prism.
Well, luckily we have a Beijing correspondent, but unfortunately for the last 11 weeks, she's been pretty much encamped on the streets of Hong Kong. Thanks to the behaviour of the Beijing-backed administration.
This is an important issue, isn't it? I mean, Matt did a very important piece for the Herald on universities and international education. That's come to the fore recently with respect to protests about Hong Kong. I think it's important that, you know, we grow our relationship with China and we understand it more. You know, I tend to go to, you know, Qingdao and Wuhan and Xi'an, a lot of the second and third tier cities now. You know, these places that the Chinese tell me are just country towns and they've got 23 million and 38 million people, you know. And you meet a lot of Australians there, of course, now, you know, like, you know, there's wineries in South Australia who now just produce for Qingdao and the state of Shandong because, you know, they don't want to compete against the French and Germans and Chileans in Shanghai. So I think that understanding is growing. But I think an important point to make is that we do have very different institutions, and I think China's been a bit shocked by Hong Kong, and I think China's...
Do you mean China's been shocked by the reaction to what's happened there?
Yeah, they have, and they're having to learn about operating in different environments. I think even economically, the Chinese state-owned enterprises that have invested around the world, they're now learning that it's not that easy being a foreign investor sometimes, you know, and they're starting to adjust their own thinking on intellectual property too. And even here in Australia, we love, you know, friendship with China, and many of us teach many Chinese students. But it's one thing to learn Mandarin, to learn culture, but, you know, you don't want an extension of the Chinese state into the student body. I think that's not good for Australia's democratic institutions, and I think many Chinese Australians would agree.
Can we talk now on the impacts of the trade war? I mean, you say, Tim, and everyone says, no one wins in a trade war. What does that mean? Why does no one win in a trade war?
Well, look at the Great Depression. I mean, we had a slump, and then the US Congress put up tariffs, and there was, you know, retaliation, and we made the Great Depression a lot worse. Whilst during the GFC in 2008, to be fair to the Rudd government, they kept tariffs low and committed to free trade as well as a stimulus and so on, and we got out of it quite well. So, I mean, I think the biggest danger of a trade war is that you have beggar thy neighbour policies where someone puts up their tariffs and then someone else retaliates by putting up their tariffs even more, and you get a bit of an escalation. And at the end of the day, you know, the great Cambridge economist Joan Robinson used to say, putting up tariffs is like putting rocks in your own harbour. Ultimately, you hurt your own farmers and your own consumers and your own manufacturers. And I think that's what's happening in the US. I think the soybean farmers of Iowa and the exporters of Harley-Davidson motorcycles in Milwaukee, they're actually being hurt by Trump's own tariffs. And it, you know, it can't be good for the US economy or the world economy, particularly a small open economy like Australia, where, you know, one in five jobs depends on exports and trade.
If you want an insight into the seriousness of the situation from a global economic point of view, just listen to the economic officials from the big institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, the OECD. They're all using more and more urgent language, strong language, which is not really their strong suit, not what they normally do.
Outside that's what their they comfort are doing. Zone.
And indeed, our own Reserve Bank.
You they know, want to understand it.
Yeah, that's right. They're becoming more and more, as I say, strident in their language about how dangerous this is. And I think you can look at it from the Australian point of view. Obviously, there's a lot of predictions that this will lead to lower global growth. That's bad for all countries, especially Australia, which is a small open trading nation. We send about 34% of our exports to China. It's a very high share compared to most other countries. And so this obviously China is in the frame for this. And if the Chinese economy were to slow, were to be disrupted as a result of the trade war, you can just, again, see how Australia would be directly affected. And indeed, the point is that we're already facing headwinds here in Australia. There's already some challenges in the economy, you know, with the downturn in the housing market, with, you know, very soft growth, low inflation, low wages growth. This is another negative to add to that already kind of difficult challenge that's there. And so you can see how it does pose a real danger to us.
So to sum up, with the very strong caveat that it could all change at any moment, depending on the next Donald Trump tweet, what is the current state of the trade war? Could I get the assessment of both of you on where we're at in it? Is it just the beginning? Are we headed for a deal? How big is the risk?
I think that it's impossible to know. Like, if you look at the rhetoric of both sides over the past weekend, it's not different to what we've had in the past. Trump has actually told us that they came very close to a deal early this year and it all fell through. So it depends on whether these remarks over the weekend actually mean anything different to what was happening before. So I guess it's at a pretty tricky point. But I think even if they do come up with a deal, as we've been discussing, there are dangers in that deal for Australia and probably won't overcome some of these really big issues that we've been talking about, like the future of the World Trade Organization. How does the world manage the emergence of China and indeed other big Asian countries like India, which are all sort of bubbling beneath the surface of this trade war?
Tim, where are you on the scale between pessimism and optimism on this?
Well, I'm actually hoping that the advent of an election in 2020 will actually help the world and help Australia. I think if you look at Donald Trump's past history before he was president, he would generally get into a huge spat with someone as a property developer or in another type of event, and he would declare victory and spin it very well. Even though when you look at the court judgments or if you look at the details of the negotiations, he actually hasn't always won that much. So what I'm hoping is that if history's a guide, he will get some minor concessions from China, not much at all, but declare a huge victory to take him through the 2020 election. And therefore, the adverse impact of a trade war will be minimised from an Australian and world point of view. So that's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping that he doesn't win the negotiation, but he does a deal and declares an enormous victory to give him enough political momentum to get him through the 2020 election. And of course, if he doesn't win, then we'll have a new president. I suspect that had Hillary Clinton won or if a Democrat had been in 2016, we still would have had some tensions with China trade-wise, but we wouldn't have had this erratic, you know, Twitter storm. So I'm hoping that he can claim a victory, whether it is or not is another question, but enough to minimise the possible adverse impact on the world economy, which, as Matt and I agree, could be pretty tough if it escalates.
Tim Harcourt, Matt Wade, thanks so much for this week.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
That was Matt Wade, a senior writer from the Sydney Morning Herald, and Tim Harcourt from the University of New South Wales. As always, keep your topic suggestions coming through to the team via email. The address is in the show notes. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our newsrooms. So to support independent journalism search, subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. This week's episode was produced and edited by Yuji Shimada, with recordings by David McMillan. Amelia Maguire manages our logistics and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.